From prison computer hacks to Medicaid expansion to the latest on a new stadium, Boise, to education, we are discussing all of this and more since it's Friday and time for our reporter roundtable. My panelists today includes Kevin Richert with the Idaho Education News, Kimberly Crucey with the Associated Press, and Sven Berg with the Idaho Statesman. Welcome. Happy Friday. It has been a busy and, shall I say, kind of crazy week?
Yeah.
A little.
A little? Okay. Let's start with this JPEG computer hack. Kimmy, I saw your tweet last night, and that's how I found out about it. And so explain to folks maybe who are just catching up on what's going on with this.
Sure. So I tweeted out this story, gained some traction. However, it was my colleague, Rebecca Boone, who works for the AP, who first broke the story yesterday. And essentially, Idaho's Department of Corrections told her that roughly 364 inmates had hacked the computer tablets that are given to these inmates to check email, music, to give credits to their system. And they had essentially transferred about $250,000 into their accounts. That really caught some people's attention. So,
just a little.
Yeah. So according to IDOC, roughly 50 of these inmates transferred about $1,000 to up to $10,000 into their accounts.
Go big or go home.
Right. And so the IDOC is continuing to investigate. They are saying that, you know, this isn't Idaho taxpayer money was lost on this. This is just, you know, they are hoping to seek, get back mm-hmm. this money. But this isn't necessarily taxpayer money. But this is definitely an Idaho taxpayer, you know, issue to pay attention to about what our inmates are doing with these JPEG tablets.
And explain these JPEG tablets, because I guess I was not aware that they had access to things like this. And I think maybe a lot of people don't realize that.
Right. I mean, so according to Rebecca Boone's story, these are pretty popular tablets. These are pretty popular in prisons across the country. Prisoners use this. Inmates use these to email their family back at home. It's kind of like a way for them to check in, you know, look at music. So this is probably just keeping up with the times rather than like giving them a CD player. They can have a tablet, and they have JPEG, you know, contracts with states across the country. So, this might be surprising to people who aren't familiar with the prison system, but these had been in place for a while.
And you were saying before we went on the air that they have only recovered about $65,000 of this $250,000.
And we're going to be continuing following the story about how they continue to recover the rest of the money, but they've recovered about $65,000. And just to be clear, this wasn't happening at just one prison in Idaho. This was happening across multiple prisons. Becky here in her story lists it was happening at the Idaho State Correctional Institution, the Correctional Center, the institution in Orofino, the South Idaho Correctional Institution, and the Correctional Alternative Placement Plan Facility. So multiple prisons in Idaho were in on this scheme.
Yeah. And so we will, of course, keep up on that. IDOC looking into it at this point. And I want to talk about Medicaid expansion. We've talked about this right here on the program. It will be on the ballot come November. But Kevin, you were talking about the Idaho School Board Association is actually giving an opinion on this.
Right. The School Boards Association took what I thought was a fairly unusual position in weighing in on the Medicaid expansion issue. So backtrack a couple of weeks. The Idaho Freedom Foundation, which has emerged as the leading opponent to the Medicaid expansion initiative, opined that if the state opts to expand Medicaid, it's going to pit Medicaid funding against public school funding. So if you expand Medicaid, it's going to hurt public school funding. The School Boards Association came out with a competing guest opinion of its own saying that this is a false equivalency. It's not going to happen that way. And that schools are actually helped by having students in good health, that this is basically coming out in favor of the expansion for all intents and purposes, which I found interesting. I mean, the School Boards Association may not be well known to many lay people, but they're fairly prominent in state political circles mm-hmm. and very prominent at the State House. So significant to see them come out on this issue.
And any word from the Idaho Freedom Foundation since the Idaho State, the School Board Association basically came out and said, no, this will help kids?
I haven't spoken to them, but I don't suspect that they've – I think they're going to stick to their guns on this issue. I think this is a – a prelude to what's going to be a very contentious battle.
Well, there hasn't been a direct response, I think, to the School Board Association's editorial. The Freedom Foundation has doubled down in saying they've expanded not just this could threaten education spending. Like, they are arguing this will threaten transportation spending and correction spending. And I think I will be interested to see if more groups might start, you know, bristling against that, because I don't think it's just the education groups that are going to be fighting back against, you know, maybe these false equivalencies when it comes to spending.
Mm-hmm. And talking about spending, Sven, how about so we had this proposal for this stadium near downtown Boise, and it looked like it was going to happen or was on the road to happening. And then all of a sudden this week, no.
Well, I think it was on the road to a courthouse.
Well, that's true.
And I think you had very influential people lining up against it. You also had a very vocal, probably a minority of the population, who was also vehemently against it for a variety of reasons. Traffic. I mean, all the reasons you see for any land use controversy. And then, you know, we just started hearing over the last few weeks, you know, and I kept hearing things, was never comfortable reporting them because it was all off the record stuff. And I don't like reporting, citing off the record sources. But finally, we made a little bit of headway and finally got the co-owner of one of the companies who's in negotiations to say, yeah, we're in negotiations to sell part of this piece of land that we own out in the West End. So Whitewater Park, Main Street area. For part of it would go for a stadium, part of it would go for apartments, that kind of thing. So obviously a big departure mm-hmm. from the original plan, which we'd been talking about for a year and a half now.
But years ago, there was talk that if they were going to build a new stadium, it would be in that area where the Whitewater Park is now. So they're back to that idea.
Yeah, I think a lot of it has to do with just the politics of it. You know, I think that location was not the only – obviously location was not the only complaint that people had, but it was one of the really, really big ones. I think my guess is the developer, Chris Shane, looked at the West End location and he said there's just going to be less entrenched opposition to this. And he's been through some heavy slogs in the past several years getting stadium projects done in other states. And, you know, maybe he just didn't want to deal with it.
So what happens with the land right there in Americana now?
That now has changed hands. Essentially, it is now moving over to a company that owns to some of the people who are the leaders of AgriBeef. And then another company who it's really kind of hard to figure out who exactly is in it. It was established on Monday by...
The company was established on Monday?
Yes. It's called AmeriShore, so Americana Shoreline, by a guy who is an attorney. From what I can tell, his highest profile case has been representing a couple of doctors in a bankruptcy case in Spokane. And I'm sure that there are local people involved. Who those people are, we could probably all guess, but I wouldn't want to speculate, you know, on the record on that.
And then the question is, what becomes of that land then, since we don't know this brand new company that came up on Monday?
That's the big question, or one of many big questions. And the answer right now is, I don't know.
I'm speaking with Kimberly Crucy with the Associated Press, Sven Berg with the Idaho Statesman, and Kevin Richert with the Idaho Education News, talking about everything that's happened this week. Another big story, Ada County Treasurer Vicki McIntyre being charged with 7 felony counts of misuse of public money of a public officer. And she was accused of this before, correct?
Yes. Well, these allegations that the AG came used to file the charges on Wednesday were first brought up when Vicki McIntyre was running for state treasurer.
Right.
She was a leading candidate in the GOP primary for that seat now that Ron Crane, who is a 5-term state treasurer, is retiring. She, the Ada County officials asked her to turn over her credit card in April, a month before the primary, and she refused and said, no, they're out to get me. No, I'm not going to do that. Now we know, according to the AG's complaint, that the Ada County Commissioners basically filed a complaint, basically asked the AG's office to investigate her. And, several months later, we have now these charges that she allegedly was using the county credit card for personal purchases. Vicki McIntyre says that she paid back the county and that everything that she did was legal, and she's going to I think she gave a statement to the Statesman or the KTVB or local news outlets saying that she plans on defending herself and fighting these charges.
And she is suspended at this point from
the
job. Yes,
she's suspended with pay. Ada County Commissioners on Thursday, upon hearing the complaint, being alerted, went into an emergency session. And following Idaho code, they basically said, hey, we're going to suspend you as this investigation continues.
And what I think is interesting about this is their allegations saying you misused the credit card and her saying, well, I've paid it back. Well, it was still a company credit card for all intents and purposes. So that's legal, just legal rigmarole, basically, to see how all of, how that works and what will happen with that. But being indicted with 7 counts, so it'll be interesting to see how all that plays out.
And the 7 charges are 7 different times that the AG's office say that she allegedly used this card inappropriately. And the amounts of how much she was spending weren't listed in the complaint, the exact amounts. So but we know that she was the complaint outlines hockey tickets and taxis and a trip to a museum in Arkansas. So not totally exorbitant amounts, but also very these are definitely – they look like personal uses that she says that she has paid back.
And we will, of course, keep updated on that. We're continuing our conversation with our Friday Reporter Roundtable. My panelists today, Sven Berg with the Idaho Statesman, Kevin Richard with Idaho Education News, and Kimberly Crucy with the Associated Press. So, Kimberly, there was an article in the CDA Press about Lieutenant Governor candidate Kristen Cullum basically saying she said Brad Little did a good job as Lieutenant Governor. Now, the rub in this is that she and Paulette Jordan, haven't they kind of decided to run as a team? But Paulette Jordan has not said the same things.
Right. The Quarterly Press, over the weekend had an interview with her where Kristen Cullum is traveling up in that part of the state. And they asked her what she thought of Brad Little, since she would be – who is our current lieutenant governor running – who is now our gubernatorial Republican nominee for Idaho. And she spoke very highly of him, said that he had done a good job, and then she went further and said, I could definitely see myself working with him, And I found this interesting because, yes, she and Paulette Jordan, who is the Democratic gubernatorial nominee for governor here in Idaho, have come out and right before the primary said we are a joint ticket. And even though joint tickets aren't really a thing in Idaho, they basically said we are a team and we're going to be running together. We endorse each other. We support each other. And to be very clear, Kristen Cullum, further down in that article, said, I fully endorse Paulette, and I will continue supporting her, and she is my nominee. However, Paulette has been very critical of Brad Little and she has, accused him of not doing enough on health care, particularly when it comes to pushing for Medicaid expansion. She, has said it's, you've had enough time and you haven't done anything. And so for Kristen Cullum to kind of come out and say, well, I think he's done a good job, I think we're getting to see what does a joint ticket look like here in Idaho? Mm-hmm. I think, the first joint ticket that we've seen kind of like this. And so I think this will be something – how their dynamic works will be very fascinating to watch as the election day gets a little bit closer. We're still far out, but we're getting there.
Yeah, well, and would you say she's hedging her bets? And what I mean by that is when she says in the article – I could see myself working with him. I mean, something to that extent. It's kind of like, so just in case he wins.
Yeah, I think she, she posted about this on her Instagram, too, that she, doesn't want to. This is her first time running as a candidate. And she seemed to be pretty much like, I'm here to work with anyone, I'm here to help Idahoans. And my message isn't just going to be one partisanship. It's going to be like, I'm here to work at the table. Please meet me there. She is a veteran. She is a businesswoman. And she called herself a fiscal conservative in that interview. So I think she is trying to appeal to a bunch of different people right now.
And Kevin, something that will be coming out, in the next month, right before school starts, a brand new list from the state of Idaho. And it's going to make, I'm sure, many parents, many educators, many people scratching their heads about this one.
Yeah, this will be watched very closely. In mid-August, the state is going to issue a list of the lowest performing schools in the state. The bottom 5% performing schools in the state. Now, if you're wondering why this is happening, this is part of compliance with the new federal education law. Every state has to come up with some sort of an accountability system, some sort of accountability method. And part of what the state is doing is identifying these lowest performing schools. Now, with that dubious designation also comes money. The plan is once these schools are identified, they will have a share of about $2 million in new money that will be used to help the schools come up with turnaround plans, improvement plans over 3 years. So the state is saying this is not being done to shame the schools or to embarrass anybody, but to identify schools that need help getting their performance up to a higher standard. But, you know, this is going to come out in mid-August. It's going to come out just in time for back to school. I think it's...
Yeah, welcome back to school.
It's going to be very interesting to see how this is received in the communities when this list comes out. Because, you know, we wrote a story about it this week, and we got a bunch of comments on our Facebook page from people saying, why are they doing this? This is a terrible idea. This is awful. And aren't a lot of these schools that are going to be low-performing schools, in air quotes, aren't these low-performing schools really schools in poverty? And I would almost wager that that's going to happen, because whenever we do any kind of a metric, whether it's grad rates or test scores or what have you, there's almost always some kind of a correlation between performance and poverty. I would be shocked if there wasn't a correlation here again. And it'll be incumbent upon us, and I think everybody else who covers this story, to kind of try to put these rankings into some perspective.
So the $2 million, I'm assuming that's federal money?
I believe it's state money.
Oh, it's state money.
I believe
they have $2 million to be able to hand out?
Right. And the plan is to allow these, and we're talking maybe about two dozen schools statewide, to share this money, to get some extra help, some turnaround experts to come into the communities and say, here's what you need to do.
So then why wouldn't the state have given out this money before? I mean,
right? I think what it comes back to is it's a new program. We've really not had an accountability system in place for several years. You'd have to go back to the Tom Luna days when the state was giving out five-star ratings to the schools. And I think some people may remember that. And that was not a very popular
program
either.
What are the metrics? Have they given you that information at this point? Because they're keeping it very close to the vest until this is released, correct?
Yes. I'm scrolling on my phone right now, and I have to correct myself that $2.1 million is federal funding, not state funding. But to answer your question, now that I've done the mea culpa, we're talking about student achievement, student growth, grad rates, test scores, and it also includes responses from students, student surveys on how they feel about their school, how they feel about the learning environment. So it's a whole variety of metrics. And when Clark Corbin wrote our story this week, he was told that the state does not have this list yet, that they're still doing the calculations. So my guess is word will go out to the schools on the list ahead of time. And then the list comes out probably in mid-August.
In a way, I mean, it's a good and a bad thing. I mean, in the sense that you don't want to hear that the school that your child is going to is a poor performing school or teachers. I mean, there are so many trickle down things about having something like that on, you know, saying that you're a poor performing school,
right,
especially when we know that it will likely be based on, you know, poverty issues and things like that. However, if you're talking $2 million coming into the state to help these schools, that could make a difference. Or could it not, Kevin?
Well, I mean, and that's obviously the hope. And we've seen this happen in other schools. I mean, we go back to the five-star ratings of a few years ago. Horseshoe Bend received really low ratings back a few years ago. And what we saw and what we've chronicled is district leadership took that on as a challenge. They said, well, this isn't acceptable. Let's fix this. Let's improve. And they have made improvements up there. So it can happen. But there's going to be a lot of consternation, I suspect, when this list comes out.
Well, and I would just say, in a Republican-dominated statehouse like ours here in Idaho, lawmakers love accountability. And so I'm really curious to see how this tension with, you know, the public's feedback, community feedback, was saying, you know, like, how dare you call us like a low-ranking school, when a lot of lawmakers, when they're handing out money, they say, well, how are we going to be holding these institutions accountable? And how do we know that what they're doing with this money is responsible? And so there can be at times a tension between those two.
Mm-hmm. It could be very awkward for a legislator who's been calling for accountability to have to deal with the reality that a school in his or her legislative district just made this list. So a lot of political ramifications, I suspect.
And that's going to be the interesting thing. Well, we will definitely have you on when the list comes out. And Kimberly, I wanted to talk about the Idaho Transgender Birth Certificate. There's some new rule changes to this.
So yes and no. Okay. I was going through the rule change. I mean, so in April, earlier this year, a federal judge said the way Idaho handles birth certificate gender changes for transgender people seeking to change their birth certificate was illegal. And so Idaho had to come up with a new system. And so because of the ruling, the judge gave them until April to figure something out. So they had to go on a very quick timeline. So we have these temporary rules right now in place that basically say if you you just have to get a notarized application and they will change the birth certificate and there will be no record that there was a change. Mm. Respecting people's wishes to change their gender identity, their gender marker on their birth certificate. I asked the state how many people have submitted applications for this, and they said about 30. So as of early July, okay. Mid-July. What I found very fascinating with this is that this rule is currently in place, but it's going to need legislative approval, final legislative approval for it to be a permanent rule. And we are seeing some Republican lawmakers, just a handful right now, calling on citizens to oppose this. They are coming out against it. They're framing it in the way that we shouldn't be changing vital statistics and that we should be protecting the integrity of the records. So this could be just a handful of folks, but the public comments that were submitted to the state have been mainly negative from folks opposing this. And so my story was basically to kind of shine some light on this, but also kind of I'm anticipating in about 6 months when lawmakers are back in session that this will be a topic of discussion and possibly a litmus test for some, on these social issues.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. Very, very quickly before we go, Sven, I want you to quickly talk about these towers that are now going to be downtown, but no sky bridge. And this is Scott Ludwig, who is a city council person for the city of Boise, but also building these buildings. Yeah. Where are we at with this?
Well, first of all, there is going to be a sky bridge if it gets built according to plan. Of course, there's no guarantee that any of this is going to be built. It got city council approval Tuesday, and that's pretty much where we're at. I talked to Scott Ludwig that day, actually, and he said he doesn't think he'll have any problem getting financing for it. He said he's already had dozens of calls from people saying, hey, I want to buy one of those condos there. Everybody knows that Boise's real estate market, especially for housing, is super, super hot right now to the detriment of many. One of the big concerns from people is that, yeah, maybe this is more housing, but who's going to live here?
Housing for whom?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the city council wanted some members of the city council wanted some kind of affordable housing. And Lisa Sanchez pointed out the lowest price on your condo right now that you're talking about is going to be $280,000. That's not affordable to most people in Boise. She's absolutely right about that. On the other hand, you had Holly Woodings, who said, yeah, but adding housing inventory, period, generally tends to moderate housing prices across the market. Both make fairly solid points on that, I think.
So we're still waiting to see then if this will actually happen.
Yeah, Councilman Ludwig didn't have a timeline for when it was going to happen. My guess would be earliest they could break ground would be late this year, which would mean completion probably sometime late next year, maybe early 2020.
Mm-hmm. All right, we'll wait and see. Always fun to have you guys on. Thank you so much for coming on. My guests today have been Kimberly Crusi with the Associated Press, Sven Berg with the Idaho Statesman, and Kevin Richert with Idaho Education News. We actually got through, I think, the whole list of things that happened this week. I know.